The lab leak theory for COVID-19 gains momentum, and the cracks in globalization reveal themselves. This is Brief Before Impact. Hey, welcome everyone. I am Matt Parker. Thank you for joining me. For those who are consistent listeners, no doubt you've recognized my recent hiatus from the podcast. During the last few weeks, my wife has brought two more lives into the world. In fact, yes, we have had twins. They are beautiful and amazing. And right before walking in here to record this podcast, my wife graciously reminded me to tell everyone, whoever listens, how amazing she is for her ability to bring new human beings into the world, which I completely agree. So now we're back doing this episode. We'll do the best we can to stay on top of these. But frankly, now I've got multiple kids. I'll just do the best I can because I really do enjoy doing this for you. But let's get right into what we're talking about today. No doubt in the last several weeks, you've seen the development from our intelligence community on a shift in the belief that COVID-19 did in fact derive from the Wuhan lab of virology inside of China. Now, this is still up for debate between other intelligence agencies, and today I'm not going to be talking about whether that's true or not, or whether this was a dog bat meat soup at some wet market in China, or who's to blame in the United States for how we handle COVID-19 domestically. No, that's not what we're going to be talking about today, but rather, what are the consequences of knowing or having a high probability that in fact this COVID-19 virus derived from a lab as opposed to just a wet market in Wuhan? What's going to be the fallout? How will things shift globally, regionally, here in the United States and other developing parts of the world, both in trade and alliances as well, from that knowledge, at least at a high level of confidence? We're going to get all into each of those pieces, talk about globalization and how we're breaking down into what is called regionalization, highlighting the consequences, and dabble real briefly into just the reshoring of America's manufacturing as a result of the cataclysmic catastrophe of the supply chain during the COVID-19 pandemic. But before we get into all those details, let me just take a quick ad break, and then we will get to work. All right, welcome back, everyone. Let's give the quick overview just as a reminder in case someone missed it who does, in fact, listen. According to the Wall Street Journal, the U.S. Energy Department has concluded that the COVID pandemic most likely arose from a laboratory leak. That's according to a classified intel report recently provided to the White House and Congress. The shift by the Energy Department, which previously was undecided on how the virus emerged, is noted in an update to a 2021 document by the Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines' office. The new report highlights how different parts of the intelligence community have arrived at disparate judgments about the pandemic's origin. The Energy Department now joins the FBI in saying that the virus likely spread via a mishap at a Chinese laboratory. Now, four other agencies, along with a national intelligence panel, still judge that it was likely the result of a natural transmission, and two agencies are undecided. Let me give you direct quotes from an actual unclassified intelligence report that essentially sums up what the intelligence community believes about the origins of COVID-19. And I'm not going to cherry pick, but I am going to kind of summarize with some direct quotes here. So, four intelligence community elements, those are like actual agencies, and then the National Intelligence Council assess with low confidence that COVID came from natural exposure to an animal infected, and it moved about into society from animal to human contact that way. That's low confidence, okay? One intelligence community element assesses the moderate confidence that the first human infection was likely a result of a laboratory-associated incident, and that's the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Now, the variations in analytic views largely stem from differences in how agencies weigh intelligence reporting and scientific publications and intelligence and scientific gaps. Let me give a little clarity to what that portion means specifically. I'm leveraging my experience, mind you, from when I was in Special Forces, specifically doing intelligence. And I worked with a number of different agencies and departments in DC. And let me give this clear example. The CIA and the State Department are two wildly yet similar, wildly different yet similar organizations. They have a different mission, different purposes, and that's fine. They're meant to. Because of their different missions, they attract different types of personalities. Those different personalities evaluate problems differently. Naturally, there's going to be a variety of conclusions when looking at the same evidence. That's nothing new to life itself or anything that, you know, you and I might look at the same problem and go, yeah, I come up with this answer, you came up with that one. There's nothing new there. So I want you to understand that this is the same thing for the intelligence community, which is why it's not synonymous. Oh, well, if the CIA says it, then the FBI must agree with them and DEA and so forth. That's just not how it goes. They approach problems differently based upon their mission and the people they attract to their agencies. And that's why there's kind of this variation in views. But I wanted to point this out, again, coming back to that unclassified document. And it mentioned that the intelligence community and global scientific community lacks clinical samples or a complete understanding of epidemiological data from the earliest COVID-19 cases. I'm going to fast forward a little bit to the very end. China's cooperation most likely would be needed to reach a conclusive assessment of the origins of COVID-19. Beijing, however, continues to hinder the global investigation, resist sharing information, and blame other countries, including the United States. These actions reflect, in part, China's government's own uncertainty about where an investigation could lead, as well as its frustration the international community is using the issue to exert political pressure on China. And there we have the biggest point I'm trying to make for this episode today. China doesn't know where an investigation would lead if, in fact, they open their doors to the world. More importantly, they don't like the fact that the world, led by the United States and the West, is using the issue of COVID-19, where it originated, to put pressure on China, because they do not share the same views that you and I do about individual liberty, about governance, about a great deal, many things. So with that, I wanted to paint a quick overview from another article that I thought articulated this very well. The problem with COVID-19 and how the United States isn't necessarily blameless in the situation. And then we'll kind of go into what's happening with globalization, how this COVID-19, even the war in Ukraine, has fast-forwarded so many things, and what the consequences will be of us now knowing that, with high probability, that COVID did, in fact, leak from the Wuhan lab. And I'm just going to read a quick, brief point from an article written by physician Joel Zivit, writing for MedPage Today. He writes, as the origin of COVID-19 continues to unfold, and based on the evidence, the likelihood of an accidental and negligent lab leak is increasingly taking hold. What is at stake in the search for the causes of the COVID-19 outbreak? What do we hope to gain, or what might we lose in the process? The extent of the damage done to humanity by the virus staggers the mind. The next, you know, several weeks, months will be critical in determining the truth about the origin of COVID-19, and how the world responds to that information will be very likely by be nation-changing. Now, the U.S. is not completely blameless, however, writes physician Joel Zivit. Our concern over the funding of gain-of-function research was brief. America did fund and collaborate on what was inarguably gain-of-function research on coronavirus. American scientists worked with Chinese counterparts, and many such collaborations were easily accessible in the medical literature. The highly ironically named Operation Warp Speed told a false story that speedy vaccine development occurred because of superhuman insight based on a de novo hard work. Many scientists already knew this virus very well. Coronavirus gain-of-function research is another example of the insufferable hubris that infects morally careless scientists, and we are all losers as a consequence. Again, this is according to Joel Zivit, which is powerful words. I mean, I think he really hits his own community pretty hard, being a physician and in a way a scientist himself. I feel like this is a great overview of what you see our intelligence community believing, and really what COVID-19 is. And now, if we are going to view what could be potential consequences, I wanted to paint the landscape of how if anything's going to change in this world because of COVID-19, we've already seen that begun so far, right? Think back for a moment. What do we all experience when COVID-19 happened and the world locked itself down? Well, we saw these massive disruptions in global supply chains, which brings up the question of globalization and how globalization is going to be shifted and how it will kind of bend to this new world that we're inhabiting. And I'm going to read and kind of skim through a recent blog that was by Peter Zeihan, geopolitical strategist. You've heard me talk about him before, or I certainly quote him often on Instagram. He was on the Joe Rogan podcast, which was a terrific episode. Highly recommend if you like to listen to him. I feel like Zeihan is probably the best voice at the moment of explaining the ongoings of geopolitical events in a very in-depth but relatable way. So highly recommend that. And so I'm just going to give a couple of points on what he is saying about the idea that, of globalization. And he starts by saying, the idea is that if the United States has benefited from globalization for so long, why, even if it was in danger, wouldn't the U.S. just kind of double down and keep it going, right? It's like, let's first look at why the United States did this in the first place. Globalization was never about economics for the United States. It was at least not about economics, kind of that traditional sense. The U.S. as the world's largest economy long before World War II, and with the war, we found all of our potential rivals, cooperation nations, friends, allies, enemies, everybody put together, have an economy that was about the same size as the United States. So an economic growth was hard to come by. Economic security was impossible. And a big part of what led to that competition over resources, over lands, over security. So basically all the things that have colored human history since the beginning. So the Americans came to the conclusion that when they were facing down Stalin in the middle of Europe, that there's no way that the Americans could be able to economically or politically support the kind of conflict where the Soviets were right there and we were an ocean away, especially when we'd be fighting on the territory of countries that have been absolutely devastated. So the solution was to bribe everybody, use our Navy to patrol the global oceans so that any of our allies could go anywhere at any time to interact with any other player, access any material, and especially access the American market, which was really the one only soft to survive the war, right? The catch was that you had to let the Americans write your security policies. So never forget, from the beginning, the very concept of globalization for the United States was never just about, you know, the economic benefits. It was much more about security. So, and if you look at a main reason for the idea that globalization was no longer benefiting the United States, because we're never viewed it as the same way as everybody else does, based upon the size of our economy and based upon the economies of every other country in the world. Now, the probably the biggest reason that you see this change in globalization was because of demographics. For example, when you urbanize and you industrialize, and for the most of the world, they didn't start that to really start doing that until about 1945. Or in the case of the developing world, for example, that wasn't until 1992. So you move off the farm, you go into town, you know, instead of working agriculture, now you're getting to services or industrial job. You're living in a condo, it's a townhome, you're crammed together. Kids are going to be going from free labor just to being expensive headaches, so you're going to have fewer of them. So at least for the rich world, these transition has started 75 years ago. For the developing world, it started about 40 years ago. So you play that forward, and the world is literally running out of people age 20 and under. And it's been that way for about 20 years now, which means that the world has a run into people 40 years and under. Well, the whole idea of trade, the whole idea of globalization, is someone has to buy all the stuff. And trade makes no sense if there's no one on the other end of that sale. So we no longer have the security parameters to kind of make this work, because Americans really aren't interested. We no longer have the economic basis to make the world because we don't have enough young people to consume. So what would need to happen if the United States really just wanted to get back into kind of globalization? So what would scare us into doing that, where we'd feel like we have to like pay for a new alliance? Well, for example, the Ukraine war wasn't that. You look at Biden administration and all that it's done, all the deals are on the table or on security. There's not single, you know, kind of guns for butter trade. In fact, every single trade war, every single tariff that the Trump administration put into place, the Biden administration's doubled down on, except for one. There's been a deal over airspace with the Europeans, but that's it. If anything, the Biden administration is far more anti-globalization than the Trump administration was. Or at a minimum, it's actually going in the long-term policy. So, even if the next president happens to be a strong globalist, they're going to have to unwind 8 years of anti-globalization sentiment that is now hardwired into American policy, and another 8 years under Obama of just complete strategic apathy. You're not going to do that in a four-year presidential term. So in the best case scenario, if you want to be involved in a globalized system, another 6 years before the Americans really might belly back up to the table. And by then, China will be gone. So this is, again, according to Peter Zeihan, geopolitical strategist. And what he's describing, in a sense, is because of the failures or the underlying creation of what globalization was for the United States, pivoting that into a demographic decline all over the world, but due to industrialization, urbanization, etc., what we've known as a globalized world is breaking apart in many regards. And it's kind of becoming into what is referred to as kind of regionalization, which means, for example, the iPhone, which is technically produced in over 20 different countries because different parts come from different places, that is now going to become into fewer countries. And part of it is even coming back to the United States. It's just a hypothetical example. I'll give you a real world example. Since I live outside of here, Austin, Texas, we have a Samsung chip factory going to be making semiconductors that is being made just north of town. And it's going to take a while before it gets up online. But that was a part of the CHIPS Act, and that was a huge shift of semiconductor production, manufacturing, coming to the United States. You've heard me talk on many episodes in the past. 90% of the world's most advanced semiconductors are produced where? That's going to be Taiwan. Taiwan, less than 100 kilometers away from China, who wants to take it back as they see them as just an extension of themselves. This is another reason. We've seen so many ripple effects, all coming kind of from COVID-19. Once the weakness of a globalized supply chain was revealed, because whenever the world decided to lock its people down, no longer can you work, well, what happens when you need that chip to go into your Ford F-150 and you don't have it? You got 80 ships outside of Los Angeles port, and they can't deliver their goods, et cetera, et cetera. So this is why, in Zeihan's view, globalization as we have known it is going away. And it's further getting to regionalization. And I'll give you an example of just the reshoring that we've seen of American manufacturing. And this is, again, according to LE Global Law, writes that COVID-19 pandemic affected 98% of global supply chains. Okay, industries that invested significantly in offshoring to reduce costs saw dramatic risk increase. That's according to an article in New York Times. So thus, U.S. executives are looking to reshore or put the industrial production and manufacturing to U.S. soil. It's an attractive opportunity. While relocating manufacturing may not be the lowest cost option, it might be the best cost option when you just weigh it against the supply chain resiliency and sustainability. There's the Kearney 2021 Reshoring Index, which is the primary reasons U.S. companies consider reshoring. They include labor costs, labor availability, delivery times, logistics costs, and reduced carbon footprint. The common belief is that manufacturing jobs left the United States long ago for more cost-effective offshore labor. Recently, though, offshore manufacturing in countries like China has experienced wage inflation, whereas the Pew Research estimates that relative cost of U.S. labor has remained quite flat for over a decade. Reshoring could mitigate these costs and offer better service, delivery, product quality, and brand perception. So that Kearney Index found that 92% of the CEOs surveyed stated positive sentiments towards reshoring. Additionally, 79% of executives with manufacturing operations in China have already moved part of their operations to the United States or plan to do so in the next 3 years. Reshoring efforts have occurred across many industrial sectors. Bloomberg highlights that the construction of U.S. manufacturing facilities has increased by 116% over the last year, and aluminum and steel manufacturers are building new plants across the Southeast. Semiconductor chip factories in New York have opened, according to a Vox article, to help alleviate supply chain disruption in the automotive and electronic industries. So, We've talked about in depth before, and now we're going to highlight this again. As globalization is breaking down towards more regionalization, and you see the reshoring of manufacturing, in especially here in the United States, as a response to the weakness and the lack of resiliency in the global supply chains, coming back to kind of finish off the episode of, if all this is a response to what happened with the COVID-19 pandemic, and now that we know with a high probability that the pandemic, the virus came from the Wuhan lab of virology, what in fact could be the consequences directly to China? And I'm going to finish with that article coming back from Dr. Joel Zivit. If you consider as a round number that 1 million Americans have died from COVID-19, and this virus was released through negligence, the families of these 1 million Americans could bring a class action wrongful death claim against the laboratories in Wuhan and the Chinese government. As a round number, a wrongful death claim might pay $1 million per person. That total settlement would be valued about $1 trillion, the entire amount of U.S. debt owed to China. So if you're with me so far, if Americans were to be paid for the lives that were lost because of this virus, and China was to pay that bill, that would be about $1 trillion, which is about the entire amount of U.S. debt owed to China. So if a judgment were issued against China, the obvious problem would be how to collect the money. There is no international court of civil wrongs, and China might simply object based on a lack of jurisdiction on the part of the court. On the other hand, the U.S. could decide that the most straightforward way to collect the debt from China would be to begin to seize Chinese assets. If a Chinese ship from China docked in the U.S. port, we could send the bailiff to seize the ship. The Chinese funds in the U.S. banks could be frozen. The U.S. could request neighboring countries to seize Chinese assets on the basis of pre-existing collaboration agreements. So these are just some of the ideas that if you're looking for, essentially, I was wronged, I sue you, you pay me money, this could be some examples of what that might look like in terms of consequences. Now, let me give you this last one. It's from Associated Press. Recent reporting says that China accused Washington recently of improperly attacking Chinese companies after genetics analysis giant BGI Group and 17 others were hit with curbs on access to U.S. technology on security or human rights grounds. The Commerce Department said it saw a danger that two BGI units might contribute to the government's surveillance apparatus, which human rights groups say is trying to create a database of genetic samples that Muslims and other minorities were compelled to provide. Other companies were cited for their role in the ruling Communist Party's military modernization or weapons development by Iran and Pakistan and suspected human rights abuses in Myanmar. Washington has accused China of trying to use civilian companies to obtain processor chips, aerospace, and other technologies that can be used to make weapons. Beijing retorts that the U.S. government is trying to stop potential commercial competitors. The United States, quote, is fabricating excuses to suppress Chinese companies, end quote. It's a foreign ministry spokeswoman, Mao Ni. She called on Washington to abandon ideological prejudice and stop abusing various excuses to unreasonably suppress Chinese enterprise, end quote. These are how the consequences, in my view, the consequences of COVID-19 leaking from a lab are really going to come into fruition. The United States is not going to, the President Biden is not going to go to the Congress tomorrow and asking for a declaration of war against China because of this lab leak theory. That's not ever going to happen in this instance, as far as I'm concerned. However, what is more likely, and it's frankly more effective, it's what does China so desperately need? Two things. I'm generalizations here. There's a lot of things I need, but two things on the top of my mind right now related to this issue. One, they have to be the manufacturing country of the world. Two, they desperately need to steal Western technology. In this last instance, I gave you just an example of China punishing these groups for BGI Group. Why are they going after these companies specifically? Number one, they're helping the Chinese defense apparatus to create weapons because of their access to certain genetic material. And secondly, they are trying to obtain American semiconductors and chips aerospace and other technologies. That's what they want. They have to make, think about this. Apple, the company, designs an iPhone. That didn't happen in Shanghai or Beijing. No, Shanghai and Beijing, you know, China will then take that iPhone, reverse engineer it, and create a phone of similar capabilities. They don't create, they don't innovate. That's not their culture to do so. They don't have the same respect for individual liberty and innovation that we do that allows them. Don't get me wrong, there's some massive Chinese companies that have been extremely successful. But that's why you don't see technology companies blowing up in China in terms of their innovation to the world. They steal our tech and then just remake it. What they're really good at is the beginnings and end states of manufacturing. This is why that's the first part of the point, is that they have to be the manufacturing state for so many countries. And as globalization from a demographic issue is starting to really break down, according to Peter Zeihan, then China's going to be in a real pinch. This is the real consequence for the Chinese lab leak theory coming into like a more mainstream view. It's the cracks in the globalized system, an American desire to have more American manufacturing here in the United States, and shoring up the lack of resiliency of the global supply chain. These are going to be the consequences. Companies in China are going to be punished for what they've been doing, both on the human rights aspects as well as the security threats to our own national security. These, I believe, are going to be the consequences that are underlined by the globalization issues. And it all comes down to the fact that more of our intelligence community is assessing that the fact that COVID-19 most likely came from the Wuhan lab of virology. I don't know about Fauci or any other medical representatives or even figures at that time who were promoting certain policy, what kind of the fallout would be for them. Frankly, that's more of a Republican versus Democratic issue, which is frankly political theater. What I think is important from our own national security aspect, which is kind of the underlying point of my podcast, it's I think America is in a very good position moving forward. If you think about it, we've got two oceans on either side. Our number one and two largest trading partners are to our north and south. From southern Canada to northern Mexico and everywhere in between, you start digging down to the ground, there's this shell, and it looks like a cake. And now that we have the fracking revolution, we're becoming a net exporter of energy. We've got a fifth of the world's clean water in the Great Lakes. We're in a good spot, folks. This is a good thing. The challenge, I think, is going to be for the world and America's security moving forward is as we move away from a globalized system to a more regionalized system, and countries like Russia, countries like China, and authoritarian states, whenever their domestic populations start suffering because of the breakdown of globalization, authoritarian figures like Putin, like Xi Jinping, tend to act aggressively outward. We've seen this response with Russia moving into Ukraine, and it's very possible in the short to near term China will attempt to retake Taiwan. This is the challenge for America's security. It's not necessarily here on our land, but how do our interests abroad become affected by these outward aggressions by authoritarian leaders? I hope you enjoyed this episode. Good to be back with you and go through the process. I hope you enjoyed the topic. And thanks for everybody for their kind thoughts and kind words for the twins recently being born. As always, hope you are picking up what I'm putting down. I am Matt Parker. This is Brief Before Impact.